Hey, listeners, it's your host, Aisha. So you're about to listen to my chat with collaborative pianist Madeline Sledadahl, whose name is really fun to say. If you listen to our summer music festival series this year, you'll remember the Music Academy of the West. And if you haven't listened, you'd be a lot cooler if you did. Madeline was the recent winner of a competition that they do at Music Academy of the West. More on that later. Anyway, she's super fun, super smart, and you're going to learn a lot. Thanks, Kate Oberyacht. Also, you can play a fun drinking game with all the words I make up in this episode. And once you're nice and loose, don't forget to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. Okay, enjoy the episode. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today in the studio is Madeline Sledadahl. She's a pianist and a Houston native. Along with baritone Ben Lowe, she won the 2016 Marilyn Horn Song Competition, and as part of their winnings is a recital tour that they're doing. They're going to be doing it during March in a bunch of cities, including Houston, lucky us. She is a staff pianist at Rice University's Shepherd School of Music and a former vocal piano fellow at the Music Academy of the West. If you listen to our summer series, you know what I'm talking about. Madeline, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you so much for having me, Daisha. I'm excited to be here.
So, okay, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, we did an episode about collaborative piano with Timothy Hester. But could you remind our listeners, like, what collaborative piano is?
I think, to put it very simply, collaborative piano is just the art of creating music with and for other people.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I mean, the word collaborative, that's immediately what we think of is creating and combining. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I feel like it's this sort of balance between leadership and acquiescence and following and sort of finding this line in between the two to create some new and exciting music.
Okay, so we're going to dig a little bit deeper into collaborative piano and the art that it is today than we did in that long time ago episode that we did. So I guess to get us started, could you talk about the different varieties of collaborative piano, of which I know very little?
Sure. There are a lot of different avenues and facets you can take with collaborative piano. I think the easiest way to delineate the different types would be just what instruments you're collaborating with. Mm-hmm. You can collaborate with singers, you can collaborate with string players, you can collaborate with woodwind players, you can focus on chamber music, you can focus on just duo repertoire. And there are a lot of skills that are going to carry over into all of those different categories. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, once you really start delving into these specific areas, you'll find that there are a fair amount of specific skill sets that will really help you within each of these categories and with each of these instruments.
So I have kind of a dumb question.
Never a dumb question.
But like, okay, so there's collaborative piano, which is distinctly this thing and unto itself. But then, like, I've also talked to people about pieces of music that are for piano and string, or piano and oboe, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, is that also collaborative piano?
Or absolutely. Is collaborative piano.
Oh,
so basically,
okay,
anytime a pianist sits down and decides to play with someone else, you can call that collaborative piano.
Okay.
And you're doing it right there.
Nice.
Like, it's happening. It's already happening. I think the confusion of the term, honestly, comes from the kind of more recent upstart attempts to rename the art of collaborative piano from what was previously called accompanying or an accompanist. So I don't mind the term accompanist at all. I think it's interchangeable with pianist or with collaborative pianist. I mean, I think I'll answer to many terms, but I think for a little while there was a misunderstanding that the term accompanist meant something subservient or lesser than.
Right.
And anybody you talk to these days who enjoys playing collaborative piano or working with pianists knows that that's rarely, if ever, the case. I can think of a really interesting quote, actually, that Margot Garrett said. She's a director of collaborative piano at Juilliard. And in a masterclass I was playing with her recently, she said, we were talking about songs specifically. I was playing for a singer. And she said, you can divide songs into three categories. One is where the singer leads the pianist. The second is where the pianist leads the singer. And the third is where there's a combination or a trade-off of both. And 90% of songs fall into that third category. Yeah. And so it's sort of a fallacy to think of pianists and accompanists being something subservient, because it's really just like finding that balance in between the two. And not just a balance of being totally equal all at the same time, but trading who has dominance or who leads the phrase or who leads the line and then passing it off. And that's what I think makes it so fun and exciting.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I assume it's like any kind of chamber music where, like, you've got, you know, one person on a part.
Yeah.
And like, to greater and lesser, to like throughout a piece, like one instrument might sort of fall into the background, the other might come to the fore, that kind of thing.
That's absolutely 100% right. And oftentimes, I really think of collaborative piano as just chamber music for two people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that a lot. You mentioned pieces, you know, for violin and piano. You know, you think of the Brahms violin sonatas or the Beethoven violin sonatas or Poulenc's clarinet sonata. They're called sonata for clarinet and piano, or sometimes even they're ordered Brahms sonata for piano and violin, you know? They're really just a partnership, and it just so happens that there's only two, but I really think of it as chamber music.
But I remember for the first time learning that it was kind of frowned upon to use the term accompanying.
Yeah.
Accompanist. Accompanist. That's really hard to say, by the way.
Maybe that's why it was phased out, is because it's so difficult to pronounce.
Maybe that's what some really smart person was like, collaborative is easier to pronounce.
Is it though? I fumble on it all the time as well.
I fumble on all words. But I remember learning that because I was writing up, I create web articles here too at the station. And I was writing, I started to refer to somebody in that way as an accompanist. And somebody who knows classical music much better than I came in and said, "Ooh, no, you don't wanna, that's frowned upon." Because it sounds, I think like just the idea that the other, that the pianist is in some way just there to sort of support everyone else. That's sort of like a hackneyed idea.
Yeah, now. I think the word itself, like any word, you know, it garners associations over time that maybe have negative connotations. I think the word itself is probably fine, but it's the history that comes with the word.
Right. Yeah.
It's a sort of taboo in the collaborative scene. I don't mind it personally, but I think it's something that they're sort of transitioning out of. You even see like universities and conservatories changing their masters and doctoral programs to use the word collaborative instead of a degree in accompanying. A degree in collaborative piano now. And I think it's an attempt for the classical music scene at large to what's the word I'm looking for?
To recognize the importance of what you do.
Yes, to support us. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it seems just more technically correct to say that it's, Well, okay, so we should get to some music. You've brought in some examples today.
Sure.
I know you've trained as a solo pianist.
Yes.
And you've done instrumental collaborative pianisting? That's a word. Sure. I just made that.
I love it. I love it. Let's roll with it. Pianisting.
And then, and then also, you've worked more recently as a vocal pianist. So I'd love to hear examples of like how you play differently as all of these different types of pianists.
Okay. Well, how much time do you have, Daisha?
I mean, we got like 15 minutes.
Okay, you know. Perfect. Well, I think that, how do I want to say this? I think each facet of piano playing helps influence the other. And even though I trained initially as a solo pianist, I also have a large background in doing basically collaborative piano from a very young age, mm-hmm. whether it was playing for the local high school musical when I was young or playing jazz gigs at the local wine bar when I was too young to be in the wine bar. I'll just say that. I think being as well-rounded as possible helps create independence and creativity and comfortability in all of these different arenas. As a solo pianist, you have a lot of freedom uh-huh. and a lot of flexibility. Every choice that you make is yours mm-hmm. and yours alone. And when you start adding someone else into the mix, it's not that your needs become subsidiary. Uh-huh. It's just that you can use what they are bringing to the table to then inspire you to change how you approach the piece.
Yeah.
And you will make just kind of small changes in the way that you might initially have played the phrase or made the line. You make these small changes to adapt and agree with the musician that you are playing with without sacrificing your own sense of music or interpretation.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's the ultimate goal of collaborative piano.
Yeah. That's cool. So the goal is kind of to both work equally on this, to make this one thing. That's kind of cool. So I know that sometimes you are playing parts that were written for piano, specifically for piano. And then from what I understand, other times you're actually playing as a stand-in for an entire orchestra.
Yes.
So how are those things different? Like, how are those experiences different?
So that's something that you're going to come upon playing for all kinds of instruments, whether you're playing with singers or whether you're playing with singers, you would be, you know, mostly opera repertoire, mm-hmm. and you do end up playing a lot of that. And then with instrumentalists, often you'll be playing pieces that are concertos originally written for that instrument and orchestra. And I think that orchestral piano playing is one of the most exciting and liberating kinds of piano playing there is, which I think if you'd asked me that question 4 or 5 years ago, I would have been like, ah. I don't know.
There is an eye roll that you guys couldn't see involved with that sound.
Yeah, a highly ironic one because I love it so much now. But so when you're playing an orchestral reduction, basically some editor somewhere that I will never speak to or know has taken the entire 60 to 100 to 100 plus instruments that make up the orchestra and somehow filed it down to fit onto the two staves of the grand staff and have two hands of one pianist try to play it. And so, I mean, it's a hopeless task to begin with. Like, you will never sound as grand and as intricate and as layered and as multifaceted as the orchestra can. But you now have the opportunity to try as best you can to recreate those sounds and colors and try to incorporate as many of the different lines that are going on as possible. So when this editor comes in and tries to fit everything onto the staff, obviously there are going to be things that get removed, whether it's because even just to read it looks complicated. If you have a lot of, like if you have a fugue section where maybe 5 or 6 woodwinds at a time or doing contrasting lines, trying to fit that onto two staves can be really hard to get the beaming right to make sure you can...
Beaming?
The beaming is sort of like how you would group the notes in order to be able to see which notes are connected to each other to be an individual instrument's line. And I'm doing a lot of hand motions now to talk about the different ways that the lines go. But basically, you might have a clarinet line descending down while an oboe line is ascending up. And they will sort of crisscross in the middle. And editors will use beaming in order to make it clear which line connects where.
I see.
So when you're trying to get the right articulation, you can know where you're trying to follow your line through.
Okay.
So as you can see, it can get very complicated very quickly. So an editor does his or her best to create that. But then as a collaborative pianist, we have the freedom to change it. And that, for me, when I found that out, that not only did I not have to play exactly what was written, but rather it was encouraged for me to be creative and try to find a new way and the most effective way to express what the orchestra is doing. That was so exciting and liberating and terrifying all at the same time. Because we're taught so much from a young age, especially in classical music, fidelity to the score. You know, you must be so faithful and so diligent, and every little marking matters. And that's absolutely still true. But when you start to do an orchestral reduction, instead of fidelity to the reduction score, it's fidelity to the original orchestral score and fidelity to the sound. And so how can I take this and try to recreate the sounds of the orchestra?
That makes a lot of sense now that you explain it that way.
I'm glad it does.
Why that would be more fun to do, because you kind of get to put your stamp on it.
And that's exactly right, because every pianist is going to play an orchestral reduction slightly differently.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's hear some.
Sure.
What you got?
So as a fun example to sort of delineate these differences between the piano and the orchestra, I've brought in an example of the second movement from Ravel's Scheherazade. And this is a piece I played recently on a recital at Rice. And it's originally written for orchestra. And Ravel was just one of the best orchestrators there ever was. And this is actually an interesting example because he wrote the reduction.
Oh.
Which does change things in the sense that if the original composer writes the reduction, then you should play it the way it's written, because that's the way he would have reduced it. But that's an exciting part about it, because it really gives us an eye into how he would have taken the colors and the sonorities of the orchestra and tried to recreate it on the piano, because he was obviously quite a proficient and an incredible pianist as well.
Yeah, they say he's good.
Yeah, he's pretty good. He's pretty good. So I guess first we'll listen to the original with the orchestra, so we can kind of get the atmosphere, maybe just 30 seconds or something.
So there's the orchestra playing it, and now we're going to hear the reduction?
Yes.
Okay.
Con il cuore da sua, e solo ne
That's cool. I actually like the piano version a little bit better.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why is that?
That's, well, I don't know. It has like this little like tinge of melancholy to it that I didn't really hear in the orchestral version.
That's interesting. I mean, I think there is a plaintive quality to the piano. I wonder if it's because the something that we try so hard to recreate that is quite maybe the most difficult part of orchestral reducing is the lack of sustain. You know, each note that gets played on the piano, that's the loudest it's going to be, and then it immediately starts to decay.
Yeah.
Whereas so many of the instruments in the orchestra are sustaining instruments that can continue and create sound for a very long time. And so we have to try to mask and recreate that as much as we can, either by repeating notes or by using pedal. We can find different ways to try to emulate the sustaining quality.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's not totally possible. So we we use all the magic tricks we can think of to try to recreate that.
I never really thought about that because like with the trumpet, for example,
yeah,
you can just blow on that thing.
It's the air.
Super loud.
Winds and brass have air and strings have bows.
And with the piano, it's just the...
It's technically a percussion instrument, although I think most pianists, when they hear that, kind of cringe. We're not percussive,
Okay, so what other examples did you bring for us to hear today?
I also brought an example of something that is originally written for piano, and this is for piano and baritone. It's Samuel Barber's Opus 10, James Joyce songs. This is the third song from that set. Mm-hmm. It's called I Hear an Army. And something that we didn't really get to talk about that is a big aspect of playing for singers is the existence of the text. I mean, a whole world of inspiration and opportunity and responsibility as well. It opened up when you start adding text and poetry to music. And something that I wanted to illustrate in this example that Barber does so well is text painting. So I wonder if I could just read a little bit of the text, of the poem.
Please do.
Nervous now. I hear an army charging upon the land and the thunder of horses plunging foam about their knees. Arrogant in black armor, behind them stand, disdaining the reins with fluttering whips, the charioteers. They cry unto the night their battle name. I moan in sleep when I hear afar their whirling laughter. They cleave the gloom of dreams, a blinding flame, clanging upon the heart as upon an anvil. So heavy stuff there.
That's intense, man.
You know, just a little light James Joyce for the morning. And so when you listen to the example, immediately you can hear the militaristic rhythm.
Yeah.
You can hear the galloping of the horses. You can hear the whips cracking. You can hear he uses different rhythmic motifs, but also pitch register and pedal markings to create this sense of whirling kind of insanity. And right after the singer says clanging, which is an interval of a tritone, which is, we know, the most intense interval in romantic music.
It's the devil's chord?
It's the devil's.
Right,
You know. And so right after he sings clanging in a tritone, I immediately, in tenuto markings, very emphatic, play the same tritone in the piano, clanging to... I don't know, it sort of re-illustrates the percussive, intense sound of an anvil.
Okay. Let's hear it.
I hear an army charging upon the land, and the thunder of horses plunging home about their knees. Arrogant in the cover behind them stand.
There's the gallop. You can almost think of that as like a horn call, you know, going into battle.
Yeah. laughter. They cleave the gloom of dreams, a blinding flare. Clanging, clanging upon the heart.
There's the clanging.
I hear the clanging.
Yeah, there's the tritone.
I see what you're talking about, like you're participating in illustrating the text.
Yeah,
along with the singer, you're adding that extra bit to it. Yeah.
It's so exciting and exhilarating as an instrumentalist to have the opportunity to use that text as inspiration.
Cool.
It's really fun.
That's really cool. I never really thought about that aspect of piano playing, you know, like this sort of being a part of telling the story.
Absolutely.
That's in the music, you know?
Yeah,
that's cool.
It's totally intrinsic. And, you know, we get hints of that in programmatic music, mm-hmm. even if you think about, you know.
Programmatic is the kind of music that does tell a story?
So
as opposed to, what's the opposite of that?
I don't exactly know what the term is.
Yeah, what is that term? I'll think of it
while
we're talking, and then I'll yell it out in the middle.
And we can re-edit that so we look really...
super smart.
Yeah, smart. but I guess if you think of just a sonata with the name sonata, and then uh-huh. all the movements are called allegro and adagio and rondo, you know, that's music that just stands as it is. Uh-huh. If you think of... Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words all have different titles that give you a visual picture or some kind of an idea, like Consolation or Venetian Boat Song or Romance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then which you can kind of key into and be inspired by that. But having an entire set of poetry mm-hmm. with music trying to amplify it the best way it can, that opens many, many more cans of worms and opportunities.
Absolute music.
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
That's what it is.
I remembered.
Brilliant. I thought you were just commenting on what I had said, and I was like, that's right, Deja. I love that.
Absolutely, Madeline.
That's right.
So how is playing with a singer different from playing with an instrumentalist?
Okay.
I'm sure that playing with different instruments is different than playing, you know, can you talk about that a little
bit? That's absolutely how I was going to first respond, was that I think it's tricky to put just two categories of vocal and instrumental. I think it's a bit more widespread than that in uh-huh. that each instrument family has its own waters to navigate as far as collaborating with them. If I were actually going to put it into two categories, I'd rather put it into categories of instruments that use breath and instruments that don't.
Okay.
So you have similar aspects of playing for woodwinds and singers as opposed to playing for string players who have, you know, endless lung capacity through their bow.
Right.
They are just going to phrase differently and get to a certain part in the musical line from a different avenue. Whereas if you're playing for a clarinet player or a soprano, you have to know that at some point they're going to breathe, and that's really going to affect how you begin the phrase, how you connect the phrase. And it's also, it affects how you approach each performance as well. I mean, every performance, you should always feel open to things changing. You can think of it as always approaching the performance as if you're writing in pencil, you know?
Uh-huh.
Everything always has to have opportunity and flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
But especially with the breath, you have to really be ready to adapt if something changes or if something... I don't know. I think that's one of my favorite parts also about the thrill of live music and live collaborating, is that everything is constantly subject to change, and how quickly can you catch it? And I think it all boils down to, I know you asked me about the differences, but I think regardless of what instrument or singer you're playing for, it all comes down to just kind of the concept of empathy and how much can I put myself in their shoes and in their position and try to create a setting and an outlet for them to express themselves the best they can while still feeling faithful to my own musical needs.
That is
as well.
Lovely. I never really thought about, I mean, I've kind of thought about that with regards to chamber music and just people playing music together.
Yeah.
Like you have to pay attention to each other.
Yes.
You have to like work together in order to accomplish this, you know, this sound.
Yeah.
But I think like maybe in a collaboration of two, that must become even a
very
little bit
intimate.
More intense.
It's very intimate and it's very connected. And I think that's also why it's so important to make good personal connections with the musicians you're playing for just as much as musical ones.
Is there an example that we could hear of like piano and another instrument that you think might illustrate what you're talking about, that
yes.
empathy?
Yes, we can listen to an example of the second movement of Poulenc's clarinet sonata sonata for clarinet and piano. This movement really illustrates the immensely smooth legato that the clarinet can create, which is one of my most favorite parts about playing for the clarinet.
And a legato is just a long,
long, connected, kind of lugubrious line that has as little punch in it as possible.
It's
just totally smooth and seamless.
Gotcha.
And might get in trouble for saying this, but I think the clarinet is one of the most effective instruments at creating legato. And anytime I'm trying to play legato on the piano, I think about a clarinet.
Yeah. You're going to have some angry oboists.
I really am. And they're so amazing. I love you all so much.
that was good. You've covered yourself there.
Excellent.
All right.
I don't discriminate.
So yeah, like what's going on there?
I think one of the challenges and exciting things about playing a piece like that with clarinet is, as I said, they're so effective at creating this long, effortless line. And we, as you can hear, the piano has just sort of pulsing, plodding chords underneath. And how can we use those chords in order to help move their line without impacting its seamlessness?
Mm-hmm.
And something that a great clarinetist will do is they will show me through breath pressure and subtle crescendos or swells how much they want me to move forward or pull back. And that's a really... I think this is a good example of showing how her breath support changes and impacts how I play my line underneath that.
So you guys are kind of like talking.
We're talking to each other
with your instruments. That's neat.
Yeah, we're communicating.
So okay, we've heard a piece where we've got like piano and woodwind instrument playing together, and you've kind of explained how those instruments talk to each other.
Yes.
But then you also mentioned that playing with like a string instrument is really different from playing with somebody who's using their breath to play an instrument.
And yes.
Like, so let's hear an example of that and maybe tell me what's going on in that.
Sure. This is an example. We'll use Ravel again. This is the third movement from his second violin sonata, his most famous sonata. The movement means perpetual motion, and you'll immediately understand why when you hear it. The violin is playing constant 16ths for the entire duration of the movement, which I think is about maybe 2.5 or 3, depending on the daring quality of the violinist and the pianist together. And this is a style and a technique that would be almost impossible to recreate on an instrument that uses breath, because, as it says, it's perpetual. It's constant. And the key with this one is really to get into a groove and trust and just let it roll.
Okay.
So.
That's cool. It's like the instruments are jumping around each other.
Yeah.
I like that.
And that's a pretty clear example also of, even though the violin is creating such a virtuosic display, the melodies in the piano. Mm-hmm. And so even though the violin is having so much to keep under his or her fingers, he or she then has to take that supportive role and let the melody of the piano's right hand come out. So that's another example of kind of checks and balance system of collaborative music making.
Yeah, and so different from the woodwind
piece.
Yeah. Well, Madeline, this has been awesome. And before we go, you must tell us where people can go and hear you perform. That's coming up in March, right?
Yes. So the first performance of a four-city tour that Ben Lowe and I will be doing, it happens to be in Houston, which is very exciting that they added a date here.
I'm really
excited about that. We'll be beginning the tour on March 9th, which is a Thursday, at 12:15 p.m.
Okay.
At St. Paul's United Methodist Church in Houston, and that's just on Main, pretty close to Rice University. After the Houston date, we'll be returning back to Santa Barbara at Hahn Hall on March 11th at 7 o'clock p.m. And then we'll be going to Chicago, where we'll be performing on the radio station WFMT.
Cool.
Which will be very exciting. And then our final date is March 16th on a Thursday at 7:30, and that is going to be at the Green Space in New York City in conjunction with WQXR.
That is such a cool space. I've been there before. It's really nifty. Have you been yet?
Mm-mm, I haven't been, so I'm very excited.
It's so awesome. Get the building tour.
Okay, will do. Will do. Thanks for the tip.
And we will put information about that in the web article that will correspond with this episode of the show. So, Madeline, thanks again for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been great. I've learned a lot. And actually, you reminded me of a lot of terms, too, that I've learned over the course of this show but have forgotten, like absolute music as opposed to programmatic music.
Yes.
And stuff like that. It's total learning experience.
Well, the same goes for me. So thank you so much.
All right, everybody. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to HoustonPublicMedia.org/classroom. Follow our social media there. Email me at dclay@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate us, review us, tell your children about us. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Toxic Holslander for making us sound good. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his piercing Brittany eyes. Thanks to Kate Oberyat at the Music Academy of the West for her help in coordinating this interview. Kate Oberyat, who, as you may remember from our summer series, we like an awful lot. Thanks to Madeline Sledadahl for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.